If you enjoyed these podcasts, check out Byron Reese's newest book. It's about artificial intelligence and covers all the topics addressed on Voices in AI. It's called The Fourth Age: Smart Robots, Conscious Computers, and the Future of Humanity, and it's available now wherever fine books are sold.
This is Voices in AI, brought to you by GigaOM. I'm Byron Reese. Today, my guest is Anirudh Kul. He is the head of artificial intelligence and research at AIRA and the founder of Seeing AI. He, before that, he was a data scientist at Microsoft for 6 years. He has a master's of computational data science from Carnegie Mellon. And some of his work was just called by Time Magazine one of the best inventions of 2018, which I'm sure we'll come to in a minute. Welcome to the show, Anirudh.
It's a pleasure being here. Hi to everyone.
So tell me, I always like to start off with, I don't want to call it a philosophical question, but it's sort of a definitional question, which is, what is artificial intelligence, and more specifically, what is intelligence?
So technology has always been here to fill the gaps between whatever ability is and our task. And we are noticing this transformational technology, artificial intelligence, which can now try to mimic and predict based on previous observations. And hopefully try to mimic human intelligence, which is like the long-term goal, which might probably take 100 years to happen. So just noticing the evolution of it over the last few decades, where we are and where the future is going to be based on how much we have achieved so far, is just exciting to be in and be playing a part of.
So it's interesting you use the word mimic human intelligence as opposed to achieve human intelligence. So do you think artificial intelligence isn't really intelligence? All it can do is kind of look like intelligence, but it isn't really intelligent?
Well, you know, from the outside, when you see something happen for the first time, it's like magical. When you see the demo of an image being described by a computer in an English sentence, if you saw one of those demos in 2015, you know, it just knocks the socks off when you see it first time. But then if you ask a researcher, it says, well, it kind of has, you know, sort of learned the data, the patterns behind the scenes. And it does make mistakes. It's like a three-year-old. It knows a little bit, but the more of the world we show it, the smarter it gets. So from the outside, from the point of press, the reason why there's a lot of hype is because of the magical effect when you see it for the first time happen. But the more you play with it, you also start to learn how far it has to go. So right now, mimicking might probably be a better word to use for it. And hopefully in the future, you know, maybe go closer to real intelligence, maybe in a few centuries.
It's interesting that I noticed the closer people are to actually coding, the further off they think general intelligence is. have you observed that?
Yeah, so if you look at the industry trend and especially talking to people who are actively working on it, they have, you know, if you try to ask them, when is artificial general intelligence, you know, the field that we're just talking about, going to come? Most people on average will give you the year 20, they'll basically give the end of this decade. End of this century. That's when they think that artificial general intelligence will be achieved. So, and the reason is because of how far we have to go to achieve it. At the same time, you also start to learn, you know, as the year 2017-18 comes, you start to learn that AI is really often an optimization problem trying to achieve the goal. And many times these goals can be misaligned. So it will try to achieve no matter how it needs to achieve the goal. Some of the fun examples, you know, which are like famous failure cases, where there was a robot which was trying to minimize the time a pancake should be on the surface of the, you know, the pancake maker. So what it would do is it would basically flip the pancake up in the air. But because the optimization probably was minimize the time, it would flip the pancake so high in the air that it would basically go to space during simulation. And, you know, you minimize the time. So a lot of those failure cases are now being studied to understand the best practices and also learn the fact that, hey, we need to be keeping a realistic view of how to achieve that. So they're just fun on both sides of what you can achieve realistically, maybe some of those failure cases, and just keeping appreciation for we have a long way to achieve that.
Who do you think is actually working on general intelligence? Because 99% of all the money put in AI is, like you said, to solve problems, like get that pancake cooked as fast as you can. You know, when I start to think about like who's working on general intelligence, it's an incredibly short list. Like you could say OpenAI, the Human Brain Project in Europe, maybe your alma mater, Carnegie Mellon. Mm-hmm. Who is working on it? Or will we just get it eventually kind of by getting so good at narrow AI? Or is narrow AI just really a whole different thing?
So when you try to achieve any task, you break it down into sub-tasks that you can achieve well, right? So if you're building a self-driving car, you know, you would divide it into different teams. One team would just be working on one single problem of lane finding. Another team would just be working on the single problem of how to back up a car or park it. And if you want to achieve a long-term vision, you have to divide it into sub-smaller pieces of things that are achievable, that are bite-sized. And in those smaller near-term goals, you can get to some wins. And in a very similar way, when you try to build a complex thing, you bring it down to smaller pieces. Google, Microsoft Research, OpenAI, especially OpenAI, which is probably the bigger one in who is betting on this particular field, are making investments in this particular field. Obviously, universities are getting into it. But interestingly, there are other factors, even from the point of funding. So for example, DARPA is trying to get in this field of putting funding behind AI. As an example, they put a $2 billion investment on something called as the AI Next program. And what they're really trying to achieve it is overcome the limitations of the current state of AI. To give a few examples, right now if you train an image recognition system, that typically takes somewhere around like 1 million images to train for something like ImageNet, which is considered the benchmark. What DARPA is saying, look, this is great, but could you do it at 1/10 of the data? Or could you do it at 1/100 of the data? But we'll give you the real money if you can do it at 1/1000 of the data. So they literally want to cut the scale logarithmically by like half, which is amazing. If it can be.
Right. But I mean, a four-year-old, you can do it with 3 photographs, right?
true. These are open problems that we are, you know, starting to see work on. So zero-shot learning is one of those, you know, one-shot learning or zero-shot learning. With the minimal amount of images, how we can train a system to replicate. And you can see that if you want to go towards a bigger problem like artificial general intelligence, solving these small, even the smallest, simplest thing, which is like show 3 photographs like a toddler and solve it, is a remaining problem to be solved at this point in time.
And really what people can do that's so interesting is that if you showed that toddler 3 cats, and then you went out for a walk and you saw one of those Manx cats, you know, the cat without a tail, the toddler would say, look, there's a cat without a tail, even though the notion, they weren't even trained that there was such a thing. But evidently the Manx has enough catness about it, whatever that abstraction is, that the child still correctly identifies it as a cat without a tail. And do we have to solve those kinds of, Do we have to understand how humans do that before we can teach machines to do it? Or will machines learn to do it a whole different way?
So this reminds me of the big news story from 2017 where Google...
AlphaGo.
Exactly, the story of the Google translator inventing its own language. That was like the press statement. So basically, the problem was we need to translate language A to language B. You translate English to Spanish. So, you know, you need a data set. Then you translate Spanish to French. You need another data set of two parallel corpuses. But now with the effective representation of each and every language in one way, you could actually just show it a parallel corpus of English and Japanese, and maybe another corpus of Japanese and French, and it would start to automatically translate English to French, even though we never train it for that. But how the press, you know, translated that to be like it started learning its own language. So there are, you know, explanations that can be given on how things are learned. But the interesting thing is how it can start to simulate, like the example you gave of AlphaGo, which was that it started to learn on its own based on simulations. So one thing I will mention is, you know, if you look at the trends that are happening and where we are going towards in 2019, the big area of simulation to come over data scarcity is like one of the big places how we are able to train and achieve some of this learning. And it has significant impact in robotics. As an example, when you're driving self-driving cars, you cannot basically go and have every kind of accident and then, you know, relearn how to cope in it. Another example being systems that, AI systems that are built for earthquake. You cannot go in an earthquake zone and just keep waiting for it and you'll have a few samples. So simulating those is like a great way of learning it. Simulation will basically help us, you know, achieving a lot of this.
So your particular interest is in using AI for social good, especially for accessibility. So let's start at the beginning of that story. How did you, of all the things in the world to do, why did you zero in on that? When did that happen?
So, being in the field of machine learning for about 12 years now, hackers tend to like to find interesting problems. And being at Microsoft Research, there are plenty of people to learn and work with to build something new. When I came to North America in 2015, Skype video calls would keep me and my family connected internationally. You know, happy smiling faces appearing weekly over a screen. Especially with my grandfather, but as he started to age, it became pretty apparent that his sense of hearing and vision were starting to decline. So simple conversations had to be repeated louder. And my grandfather, who was a lifelong educator, a professor, an author, and an avid reader, was having a hard time reading books. And finally, one day, he did not recognize my face anymore on the Skype call. So that was heartbreaking. So I started to look out for solutions that could help him, but was shocked to see the state of technology in the assistive space. I mean, we live in a day and age of self-driving cars. And on the other side, technologies for assistive needs were feeling decades old. So when you can't find a solution, you do the next best thing. You try to build it yourself. So I got started, met a group of like-minded folks at Microsoft, and we started to explore this area of artificial intelligence for Microsoft Research. So one of the great things in Microsoft is this whole notion of hackathons. So Microsoft holds the planet's largest hackathon every year. Last year, it had 22,000 people participating in like 50 plus countries around the world. So these are employees where the CEO literally tells them, go take a week off, knock yourself off on the idea that you really want to achieve and try to achieve it. So, you know, me and a bunch of peer friends got started on this, and we built a prototype of a talking camera. And this prototype was literally a cell phone duct taped to the head, MacGyver style. You could speak to it, you could ask it questions, and it would give you answers. And so that started to show a lot of promise. And so from that, we started to imagine how we can take this forward. So we partnered with a company called Pivothead, which makes smart glasses. You could now basically press a button on the glasses. It would take a photograph, and a few seconds later, it would give you an answer back describing the world. So from that, you know, it got a lot of attention. It got viral on the internet. And so we started asking ourselves, how do we get it in the hands of as many people as possible? And that's how we launched Seeing AI, the talking camera app for the blind community. So Seeing AI is this cell phone app that is like a Swiss Army knife. It is small, nimble, and has dozens of uses, all the way from, you know, reading books, recognizing faces, describing faces, describing scenes,